Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network, a station dedicated to the concept that all manifestations of the divine are equally valid. Join Reverend Terry Power HP, Lord Onyx, and all the hosts 7 nights a week for programming covering a wide range of spiritual topics right here on Blog Talk Radio. Under a Shady Tree with Lord Terry and Lord Onyx. Come on in, grab a glass of sweet iced tea and sit right down. These Southern Pagan boys are about to start their talk. Here's Lord Terry and Lord Onyx.
And good evening, everybody. This is Reverend Shady Power. You are under a shady tree with Terry and Robin. We've got to get that intro swapped out. And right now we're just under a shady tree with Terry. There apparently are some difficulties. Some of our guest lines are not coming through, and engineers at Blog Talk Radio apparently are working on it because I have a banner message across my switchboard. So we're waiting for Robin to get in and join us. And in the meantime, I guess I will chat for just a couple of minutes and talk about some of the exciting stuff that we've had going on. Just got back from Labor Day Libertine over the past weekend and got in somewhat late afternoon, early evening on Tuesday after a very long drive back from Indiana. Great event, great energy. We love going over to Camp Midian, and all of the people over there, always wonderful over there. So just such a great time. We met some new people, reconnected with some people, deepened our friendships with people that we had met at Horn and Honey. And, you know, I got to see somebody that haven't seen in 15 years. And I know a lot of you guys have heard me tell stories about when I used to do the rituals at the old site called Our Haven over in Indiana. And a couple of the people were a part of that original group all those years ago. I saw one of them back at Horn and Honey, and then the last member of the crowd that I had not seen was at the Labor Day Libertine event. So it was really nice catching up with her and swapping stories about some of our doings and some of our fun and rituals that we had put on way back then. So anyway, and then this coming weekend, the fall of 19th, we're going to be doing our Maybon here on the mountain, and some of what we're going to be talking with our guest tonight about some sustainable construction methods and, you know, recycling and upcycling. And he's going to be talking with us about some of that. And that's going to come into play that Maybon weekend when we do a little construction here on the mountain. So still waiting for Robin. I'm presuming that we are still having difficulties with BTR. So what I think I'm going to do is go ahead and bring Paul online. And we've got Paul Wheaton. And Paul, tell us about you. Tell our listeners all about yourself.
Hi, Terry. Can you hear me all right?
We can hear you fine.
Okay, good. Because, you know, when you just said that you were having technical difficulties, I thought, oh, no, am I cut out of the loop, too?
No, we got you. We got you, but Robin's having trouble getting dialed in.
Okay.
So
I am a guy that has been bonkers about permaculture for a long time, and I've written a lot of articles. I've put some YouTube videos up. I've made a few hundred podcasts. I seem to get interviewed a lot. There's stuff. There's forums. Oh, the big thing is the forums at permies.com. And so I have some philosophies about permaculture and growing things and building things and stuff. They're a little bit different from most. So I'm obnoxious and weird and different. And so
I will. Well, different is good in our world. So.
I guess in the world of weirdos, I'd even be a weirdo among weirdos, I think. Maybe.
Yeah, well, you know, you never know. Now, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about what is permaculture? What does that word mean, and how does it apply in our world?
I believe that permaculture is a more symbiotic relationship with nature so that I can be even lazier. Now, if you like, I can do in about 2 or 3 minutes, what is the difference between organic and permaculture?
I think that would be great.
Okay, all right. So consider for a moment the Colorado potato beetle. And so when you go and you raise potatoes in an organic fashion, you might have 40 acres of potatoes. And it'll be one great big flat field that's all somewhat homogenous. The whole field has the same pH, the same amount of water, the same everything. And then if a Colorado potato beetle lands on a plant, then the farmer's going to be like, oh, no, I'm going to lose my entire crop. And so then they do everything they can to kill that Colorado potato beetle and all the other Colorado potato beetles. They'll basically, usually what they do is they look to, like, well, what can I do to poison this, but using a poison that's OMRI certified? Permaculture is going to put a lot of crazy texture into the landscape, and we're going to have all kinds of different pHs, all kinds of different moisture levels, all kinds of different stuff. So we might have spread throughout our gardens 50 different potato plants in 50 different places, mixed in with all kinds of other stuff. So in one spot, there might be a potato plant that's not very happy, and Colorado potato beetles come and, you know, start chomping away at it. But you got to think, Colorado potato beetles, they are part of nature. They are an agent of nature. So that is a natural thing. But while that Colorado potato beetle is chomping away on that potato plant that's a little bit sad, there's another potato plant over there that doesn't have any Colorado potato beetles. That potato plant is strong and healthy, and it won't get any. In the meantime, the first one where the potato beetle or the potato plant is sad, some other plants will grow great there. So basically what's going on is that Mother Nature has looked at this potato plant and said, nah, that doesn't really go there, but don't worry. I'll take it out, and we'll grow something else there. That's the difference between permaculture and organic.
Okay. All right. So the idea is, if I'm going to paraphrase and make sure I'm understanding, it's more letting nature take its own course. And how much do you get involved with, okay, well, if that potato isn't happy in that place and it's being eaten by this beetle, something else is going to grow there. How much do you get involved with what's going to grow there?
Well, I guess it depends on how far down the road you are in permaculture and how far down the road this particular garden is. But usually if there's a plant that's not doing well, then a permaculturalist would be of the opinion like, well, then that doesn't belong there. And something else will grow there. And so we let it go. As opposed to the mentality of like, oh, no, all my potatoes are going to die. Because in the world of permaculture, you're going to have other potato plants around. And so you're going to have oodles of potatoes. If half of your potatoes die for some reason, it doesn't really matter. Usually, wherever those die, something else will thrive. Now, it is entirely possible when you're first getting started with a permaculture garden, you'll try to encourage some things more than others. And so you might, you know, one of the techniques that is very popular in permaculture is chop and drop. So we grow things in polycultures, and so there might be a lot of other plants growing around. You'll be like, I don't really want those plants. And so I'm going to cut those down, lay them down. Those are now mulch for the plants that we didn't cut down.
Okay.
Am I answering your question? I could talk about permaculture for probably 800 hours or so. But now, you mentioned in the intro that your interest is in natural building?
Yes, are. And, you know, the earthship kind of, you know, type of construction and, you know, with tires and, you know, all kinds of, you know, earth bags and, you know, we've looked at quite a few things that we want to involved with. All the idea of the sustaining or upcycling. I love the idea of taking tires that were going to end up in a landfill or having to be destroyed in some way to save the ecology from these tires. And putting them to a good use instead of them just going out there and, you know, messing things up.
Well, when I was a youngster, I had the Earthship book, and I loved on it so much that the pages started to fall out. It was a pretty beat-up copy of the book. And I was really sure that when I grow up, I'm going to build me one of these. And now that time has passed and I've been to several building sites and stuff like that, and I've heard more about them, I've elected to not build one. The thing with reusing the tires from the waste stream is a great thing. There's a fellow named Jack Spirko. He said a thing about earthships that I thought was really fascinating. He says, if you're thinking about building an earthship, go take a tire and set it out, fill it up with dirt, and do the thing where you have to beat the dirt with a sledgehammer. And by the time you're done with one, you'll probably be convinced that you don't want to do it for all the tires that you would need to do to build an earthship.
Okay.
I'd be concerned about the off-gassing myself. The people that love earthships insist that there is no off-gassing, you never smell tires, and then there are some people that say that you can. So every time I've been to an earthship construction site, it does smell strongly of old tires, and so I'm worried about off-gassing.
Okay. Well, that was
I'm
one
sorry,
of my...
Am I crushing your dreams?
you know, disappointing. I'm looking at trying to look at different sustainable ways, or, you know, maybe not sustainable is not the right word, but ways to work with this so that, you know, we take some of that stuff out of the waste stream.
Okay.
And
Something more earth aligned.
Yeah.
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 Something
I know that these are going to be labor intensive. So that is one thing that I have already gathered. That, you know, pounding these things full of dirt.
Right. I think that most people seem to gravitate towards building with cob or with straw bale. The problem with those two is that you're kind of taking a conventional floor, a conventional foundation, and a conventional roof, and you're just substituting the exterior walls with either cob or straw bale. Cob is a material it's earth. It is clay and sand. And it's so beautiful. Anything your imagination can give you is something you can build with cob. It's so structurally powerful. It takes almost no knowledge whatsoever, but it is time-consuming. I've been kind of, along the lines of the Earthships, I've been very focused on structures that, like, if a gardener designs a house, what does a gardener design? And a lot of that comes from my early days in horticulture, where I worked in an urban lot, and I was very limited on space, and I started to tinker a little bit with, like, planting things on the roof, because I was so limited on space. And I just kind of felt like every structure that I saw just did not appeal to me, because it didn't seem as natural. Even some of the cob and straw bale stuff, which is much, much further down the road, didn't seem as kind of like what I wanted. And I really liked the idea of the green roofs, you know, since I was, like, so focused on, oh, I want to grow stuff on the roof. However, your traditional green roof tends to cost about 10 times more than a conventional roof. And then the soil is only, like, you know, 4 to 6 inches thick. And it's like, wow, that's not very much soil. So eventually, now I've kind of cobbled together my own little natural building design. I don't know if you've heard of this Wafati. But as long as we sit here and we talk about, like, well, what do we want? What are the... So I've kind of come up with something that I like better. But that's just me. I'm a weirdo, so I can be weird, and I can say I like this thing better than any of the others. And so I've got something called a Wafati, and it's got a very thick earthen roof, like 3 feet thick. It's an above-ground structure with just a very thick earthen roof. It looks like a log cabin on the inside with a lot of light. And it has one bonus feature, and that is that it uses the heat from the summer to heat the structure through the winter, so annualized thermal inertia.
Okay. How is that built?
It's a log structure, so it's designed for being built in a woodland. And so you're in a woodland. You use lots and lots of logs, and then boom, a log structure. I should mention that from the outside, it looks pretty much invisible, because it's just a big collection of whatever growies are growing on the thick earthen roof, and you know, generally two or more of the walls are going to be this thick earthen kind of roof kind of a thing that extends down and becomes a bit of the hillside. So it's just one great big gob of growies. Now, we do have something we've built here at my place. We call it a berm shed, which is very similar in construction. But we got 1,800 square feet of storage space for about $93 in building material. So part of the focus of the Wafati designs is to keep costs very, very low.
Well, I'm all about that.
Yeah.
You know,
so,
that sounds pretty good. Because the cost is very low, sounds good.
I think I'm hearing like two voices at once.
Yeah, I think I'm going to play a song.
And then we're going to work out a couple of technical difficulties here, and we'll get right back after this song.
So
I'm going to play Land of the Ever Young by Darz the Bard, and we'll be back here in just a few minutes. Paul, stick around with us. And everyone listening, stick around, and we'll talk more about this construction method. And we'll be back right after this.
Right here is where you belong. There is one power in the universe, and we are perfect manifestations of that power.
And as such, we pray. We pray for peace. We pray for love. We pray for stability. We pray for the nation in which we live. We pray for the world.
We will it. We manifest it. We draw it to us. We receive it. We accept it. And we give thanks for it. And by our will, so mote it be.
To Terry and Onyx on the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. We're glad you're here. And now, back to the show.
We'll move you to Virginia.
Yeah, all right. And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Under a Shady Tree with Terry and Robin, and it's now Terry and Robin.
I'm
hey,
in real life. I'm actually here. I made it.
All right. Yeah, well, there was a big banner said that they are working on some difficulty with the host line and guest line numbers. Mm-hmm. And, quote, our engineers are working to resolve this issue. Yeah, well. All right, well, we got it done anyway. So you're here.
Yes, sir. Yes, I
and
am.
And Paul is back with us.
Hi, Paul.
I'm here.
Back with us. All right. All right, so we took our break a little bit early, so we got a good solid 20 minutes or so to talk. Now, you were talking about a construction method that you were calling, what was the name that you were using?
I call it a Wafati. So, I guess it's something where I want something that's more earth integrated. And
okay.
To me, this is like it's like if a gardener could design a home, I think that this could be it. But on top of that, a lot of the elements of the design are that the cost is very low. There's a lot of light inside, and on the outside, it's practically invisible because it is engulfed in horticulture.
Hmm. Interesting.
Okay, well, is it like dug into a hillside or something like that? Or
yes. Yes, it would be.
And we have plenty of hillside.
Yeah. And so hillside is an essential ingredient, as well as a woodland.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a woodland, it's like I don't think this would be a good design. On the other hand, I kind of think if you're going to build straw bale, that's a perfect design for when you have fields of straw.
Uh-huh. Now we've got wood.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the mountains of Pennsylvania, so I've got woodland and lots of dirt and lots of hills.
There you go.
Seven acres, in fact.
Since it is my design, I'm extremely biased for this. I'm not sure if this is what you guys wanted me on the show to talk about. I think you wanted to talk about things that were more horticultural, but I'm not sure. You tell me.
No, we are here
actually,
to listen to what you have to say, what interests you, and basically what we were wanting to know about was construction. We're about to take a stab here at building a greenhouse that's sort of half dug into the side of a hill. But we had somebody donate tires to us. I know you were saying that you weren't real fond of the tire construction because of it's work intensive and lots of other things. But it's what we have. It's a resource we have, and it's our first foray into this. So,
well, if you're going to build a greenhouse, which I'm not a big fan of greenhouses in general, but if you are going to build a greenhouse, I would like to strongly emphasize looking into Mike Ehler's design. So he's got a style of pit greenhouse, which it sounds like is kind of what you guys are looking at. It's definitely designed for places with slope and with woodland. And he kind of made a poor version of this many years ago, and it's documented in his book. And he was growing tomatoes in the greenhouse without any additional heat in December in the northern part of Idaho.
Mm-hmm. That's so, what I'm looking at. I just want to be able to grow like lettuce and tomatoes and maybe some cucumbers if I can even struggle those out over the winter. Just to augment, you know, over the winter what we can get, because produce here in central northern Pennsylvania where I am is abysmal in the winter.
Well, how cold does it get there?
The last winters we've had exceptionally cold winters, and we have had temperatures of 17 degrees below zero at probably our most severe.
Okay. So,
but that's
where,
not the norm. The norm would usually be about 10 to 30 degrees in the winter.
Okay, all right. And where Mike is at, it usually gets when it gets really cold, when he has a really cold winter, it'll get to 30 below.
Yeah.
So I think we're talking about O E H L E R. And so I can't remember the name of his book. It's like Passive Solar Greenhouse or something like that. But the key is it's Mike Ehler's book about greenhouses.
Okay. Well, thank you. We'll take a look at that.
Okay.
So.
This underground construction you were talking about is, what are you using for walls?
Well, first I want to make it clear that a wafati is, by definition, an above ground structure. So it's not like you're got little only basement windows or something. It's a fully above ground structure. You walk from the ground directly into the building. But it has the thing is it has a very thick earthen roof.
Mm-hmm.
Now here where I am in Montana, I have hundreds of acres of forest, and so I go out and I use these logs to basically make the wafati. So I shape the structure. I shape the general box of the structure, and then I put over. You put a membrane layer over it. And you talk about waste stream. Currently, I'm using some waste stream billboards, and then cover it in subsoil, kind of a dirt. Then we put down another membrane layer, which is we call the umbrella. And then we put a layer of soil over the top of that.
Hmm.
Okay.
But since you're using materials off of your own woodland, then the materials cost is kept very low.
Right. Interesting. Now, do you have to cure or kiln that wood in any way before using it for construction?
No. No, you don't.
Okay.
There are lots of different thoughts on how you might go about preparing it for use in any kind of wood structure, whether it's a log cabin or whether you're going to mill the wood with a sawmill, or what do you want to do? I mean, one of the things that I wish to explore soon is the idea of girdling the trees in the spring. And that will attract some of our local insects to crawl up and eat the cambium layer under the bark.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the bark pretty much just falls right off the following year.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't need to peel it. And plus, these bugs, when they eat that cambium layer, they kind of leave these beautiful trails behind.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I've seen it on the trees out in the yard, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of the foresters out here are very concerned about these bugs. They're wiping out our forests. But I kind of feel like, you take the organic matter out of the soil for over 100 years, what do you think is going to happen? you take away the ability for these trees to grow there.
Right.
And so now Mother Nature is just going to take those trees out, and Mother Nature has this lovely bug army to fix the problem that you created. So.
Yeah.
I think that the thing is work with the bugs, not against them.
Right. Interesting. Excellent.
Oh, very cool. And so let's do return a little bit. I know you said that you were, you know, not terribly fond of greenhouses, but, you know, we are looking at, you know, like she said, winter growing of tomatoes and cucumbers, and maybe early starting some plants from seed that, you know, with a short growing season here, sometimes you get a little bit better production if you can start things in a greenhouse and then put it out when it's ready, when it's warm enough outside. But so talk more about permaculture and how you're working with nature. I mean, say you've got a small like 4x8 garden. Is there some way that you can work with that in permaculture, or do you need to be larger than that to really have any impact from using permaculture techniques?
Well, I would be personally frustrated to beat the band with a 4x8 plot, but I do know of a lot of people that do permaculture in plots even smaller than that. But if I was limited to a 4-foot by 8-foot plot, I think the first thing that I would do is introduce hugel culture. And this is wood buried with soil. So soil covers the wood. And the wood that's inside of this raised bed of sorts would be designed to rot inside slowly, very slowly. And if you can get your bed 6 feet tall, then it will be able to go all summer long without any irrigation.
Wow.
And then if you could plant a variety of different plants in here, a polyculture, if you will, then plants feed plants, which feed plants, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And then that would be a kind of permaculture garden.
Interesting.
Now,
okay.
The great thing about permaculture is that if you build it correctly, you won't need to do anything but harvest.
Mm-hmm.
So you won't need to irrigate. You won't need to fertilize. You won't need to do any pest control. And if you get it really, really good, you won't even have to plant any seeds. Your annuals will receive themselves. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what permaculture has to offer. Does this answer your question? Am I helping?
Yes, I'm actually absorbing this, and it's running around in my brain going, okay, I could do this, I could do that. We'll have to look into this, we'll have to look into that, because we got plenty of rotting logs.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how so many people, they have, like, they live in an urban scenario, and they've got sticks and branches and dead trees and things, and their focus is, you know, how many of these can I stick into the garbage can each week until I can get rid of it all?
Mm-hmm.
And really, all those extra sticks, it's like this is gardener's gold. This is this is organic matter that we want to keep around. There's so many different uses for all those little sticks. Don't throw them away. Don't send them away. This is stuff. This is organic matter that you've grown yourself, so you know the quality of it.
Awesome. So. Here's another question from out of left field. I have 2 sugar maple trees in the yard, and you may or may not be able to help me with this, but they seem to have developed some sort of black spot growing not so much on the leaves, on the bark of the tree. And I have not been able to identify it by looking it up online. I've seen things that look similar, but nothing that looks exactly the same. Any ideas?
Well, I mean, it's kind of funny. Like when we look at colony collapse disorder, or we look at, you know, all of these other things that are plaguing our plants. So often, what we want to do is find out exactly what this culprit is, and then how do we kill it? But really, whatever it is an agent of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, okay. How do I work with this? Or you know, how have I fallen short for these maple trees so that they are succumbing to something? So now, these two maple trees are in your yard?
Yeah. When I bought the house here in 2006, they already had this. And it has pretty much, it hasn't gotten worse, but it also hasn't gone away. The only thing I could find online about any of this was that to make sure that the trees don't have a lot of leaf buildup underneath them, like leaf litter from the fall. And so we've kept, you know, I've kept up with that and kept it clean under the trees, but it hasn't seemed to affect it one way or the other.
Okay. This is so good. This is perfect. That's exactly, you inadvertently answered my question, and now I'm going to make you sad.
Oh, no.
So look at the sugar maple trees that are out in the country,
mm-hmm.
and their leaves fall under them, and yet they seem to be doing fine.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's take a look at your maple trees, and pretty much, you know, the leaves that fall and cover the ground, that's an organic matter. And part of what they do is they smother all the plants that are under the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that way the tree is not competing with other plants, like, say, grass.
There is no grass that grows under these trees. Yeah. It is so, well, they are so heavily leafed.
Yeah, let me jump in here.
What is underneath these trees?
Dirt. Dirt and the roots. And, you know, there's no grass growing. It's so heavily leafed that there's not enough sun, I don't think, gets through to grow. And the leaves did lay for many, many years, but the grass has never gone back in there since I've been taking the leaves out.
Oh, wow. It's worse than I thought.
Oh, no.
Okay. All right. Now I'm going to ask you to do...
Well, let me jump in here for 1 second. These trees don't seem to be suffering. They're growing. They're huge. They're green and leafy in the summer, and they seem perfectly happy. They just have these black spots. So the black spots don't seem to be harming the tree, and the tree doesn't seem sick.
But that the black spots have increased over the years that I have been here. So I am concerned that at some point they will overwhelm the tree. And we do have a tree farm right down the road from us that I know a couple of years ago had a pine tree blight. But I don't think that has anything to do. He actually had to burn a couple of his fields of trees, uproot them all and burn them because he just got some kind of blight he couldn't get rid of.
And again, that blight is an agent of nature, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
So it's like you know, it's as if Mother Nature came in and said, "Okay, you know, the way that you're raising these trees doesn't fit with my natural design, and so don't worry, you know, you made a mess here, but I'll clean it all up. I'll just take these out and I'll grow something else here." So. But let me get back to where I was going earlier, and that is that the stuff that's on the ground, I want to do a little qualitative analysis of what you called dirt.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm looking for is that I think your analysis is probably correct in that it's dirt and not soil. And one of the ways to tell, in fact, one of the most powerful indicators of when I see a tree and people are concerned about being sick is almost universally I see the same thing. Do you see the roots of the tree on the ground?
Yes.
Now, do you believe that that's the way nature intended? Okay.
I don't know.
The correct answer is no. No.
Okay.
No. So here's what the tree is designed to do. A maple tree is going to dump all of its leaves year after year on its roots, thus mulching its roots and adding organic matter onto the surface. Now, of course, if you take away that organic matter and then the tree continues to pull organic matter out of the soil gradually turns into a dirt. And dirt, the difference between dirt and soil is that dirt's going to be low on organic matter.
Gotcha.
And so as you extract all the organic matter out of the soil, it sort of deflates. And as it deflates, the roots become more and more exposed over the years.
Gotcha.
Okay.
So I think that the best thing to do is, I mean, in this particular instance, is to allow the leaves to accumulate.
The kids are going to love you. Because I have to tell you that in my life, I mean, I grew up in a suburban setting, and I can remember raking leaves a lot when I was a kid. And as an adult, I swore I would never rake leaves again, and it's always been my thing to just let them, you know, blow around the yard and accumulate somewhere, and then use, and exactly what you're saying, use it as mulch for next year's garden and just put it on top. And then in the fall, I usually would take them and, you know, bury the vegetable garden in the leaves, because it's good for the soil and it keeps everything, you know, warm over winter. Just something my grandmother taught me to do. And it always went against my nature to take the leaves out from underneath the trees, except that I kept reading it online. I read it in like three different places, and I was like, well, let's see what it does. But it hasn't helped them. And it's been, well, 5 years now, I guess, I've been taking the leaves out from under the trees.
Okay, try it. Try it. And
not yet. We're going to leave them this year. For sure.
I mean, think about it. It. So much of permaculture is how to have all the things that you want,
mm-hmm,
while being far, far lazier than everybody else. So, I mean, now there are issues with leaving the leaves. There are, I mean, like, the leaves will mat and form a nearly impermeable barrier, and it can even make the tree a little bit sick, as air can't get past the leaves. But that's not very often. That doesn't happen very often. That's very rare. And some people, what they do is rather than raking the leaves up every year, they're trying to get a lawn to grow up at the same time. And so when the leaves drop, what they do is they set their lawnmower on mulch,
mm-hmm,
and they kind of mulch all the leaves. They kind of mow the leaves.
Right.
And then it leaves behind little leaf particles, which break down over the winter. And then the lawn comes back healthier than ever, and the tree is healthier than ever.
Mm. Okay. You heard him, Terry. That's my lawn, man. The kids will be, like I said, the kids will be thrilled they don't have to rake all those leaves and you know, dump them down in the compost pit this year.
Well, I'm glad to make kids happy, yeah. That's what I'm all about, sort of.
Absolutely.
Kind of, a little bit, maybe not at all, but yeah, a little, yeah, sure, what the hell.
Mm. So here's one more question I have, since I'm allowed to pick your brain.
Sure.
We got chickens this year. And this is a new thing for me. We have five chickens. I've seen and read very varying advice about what to do with the chicken poo. Is it usable in the garden? Some people say not to use it in the garden because chickens have diseases and you don't want to use chicken poo in your garden.
Oh boy! All right. So I've been asked many times about my philosophies on chickens, and normally it started off where people would invite me into their farm or their garden, and they'd say, look at my chickens, praise my chickens, praise the way that I'm raising chickens. And I can't, because I've got this set of philosophies that are very, very different about how to raise chickens. So I got to say that, and I wrote an article. I took all my ideas because I didn't get a chance to really say the things that I thought. I wrote an article, and people hated it. All these people raising chickens, they just hated my article. But I finally got to say it. But the great thing was, is by writing the article, suddenly I started finding hundreds of people that came to the same conclusions that I did, and they were raising their chickens this way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to say that it's been like about 8 years now, and I love this approach so much. And you never have to think about chicken poop again.
Oh, cool.
So most people, when they raise chickens, they do coop and run. So they've got like a little caged area that the chickens can run around in, and there's a little coop in there. And they got to go and clean out the coop, which really stinks. And they got to – sometimes I've seen chicken runs where the ground level inside the chicken run is 3 inches taller than outside the chicken run, because that's just how much poop has accumulated over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And that bothers me. So the system that I have is a paddock shift system. So you'll set up four different, like chicken runs, four different areas that the chickens can be in. And then they're in each area for like a week to 10 days, and then they move to the next area. So then that area gets at least 28 days to recover before the chickens are back into that area.
Right.
Now, the portable chicken coop is going to have no bottom in it, and then you can drag it to each of the areas, each of the different paddocks, each time you do this. So then you don't have any poop to clean up. So the chickens are inside a little portable coop. They poop right onto the ground on soil, good, rich, healthy soil. And then when you move the portable coop to the next area, you just leave the old spot behind, and it gets overgrown and growy. And then by the time you get back to that, you can't find any of the chicken poop.
Right. Interesting. We have a stationary chicken coop, but I generally let the chickens out to wander around the yard. I let them free range most days.
Okay.
Unless it's really, like, nasty out. And I am anticipating the weather with some trepidation for the winter. I've talked to a few people, and I've gotten a lot of different input. Some people say you have to heat the chicken coop all winter long. Other people say, no, you don't have to heat the chicken coop. They'll be fine. I have a good friend who has a sustainable farm in upstate New York, and he says he lets the compost build up in the bottom of his chicken coop to keep it, to help keep the chickens warm during the winter. So I am sort of not really sure which is going to be the best option. My third option was to take the chickens for meat over the winter and buy new ones in the spring and then just rotate that every year. But I'm not really sure what the best option is, because I hear they don't lay much during the winter anyway, because they have to have 10 hours of daylight. And I'm going to be hard-pressed to get them 10 hours of daylight. I'd have to put lights in the chicken coop. And I'm not sure that that's an expense I want to offset to get eggs.
Okay. All right. From just the things you said, I've got like a four-hour response, and I want to try and condense it down.
I love this guy.
Okay. You've got about 5 minutes.
I don't like the idea of having the compost inside the chicken coop. I think one of my rules of raising any kind of animals or any kind of farming is if it smells bad, you're doing it wrong. And I imagine that when you go into a system like that, it just smells terrible. Now, there are deep bedding systems that we could talk about and stuff like that, but I still don't like it because the off-gassing that comes from that is something I wouldn't want to live in, and I wouldn't want my chickens to live in that either. The next thing is about the lights. A lot of people do the lights. It's not a perfect solution, but it does help. And the thing is that the people that are new to raising chickens or new to using the light bulbs, I want to make sure to say that you want to put the light bulb in on a timer so that the light comes on at like 4 o'clock in the morning. Don't set the timer to be such a way that it goes out in the evening, because otherwise the chickens are like, you know, sitting around the coop, they're dancing, they're watching TV, they're visiting, and suddenly the lights are out. And they're like, I can't find my way to my roost.
Right.
Whereas if the light pops on at 4 o'clock in the morning, it's like they got dark, they found their way to the roost, like normal, everything's good, and then suddenly at 4 o'clock in the morning, bink, the light comes on.
That actually makes sense.
A really common trick, because chickens are a jungle animal, and in the jungle, we don't have shorter days in the winter. It's 12 hours a day every day. So you want to try and, you know, when you're in a northern climate and your days are getting shorter, and you maybe only have 6 hours of light, emulate the other six. Bring it back up to 12.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I could talk about more things, but I don't think we have a lot of time.
Yeah, actually, we are at the point now where it's time for you to tell people that are listening to the show how they can get in touch with you.
I think the best way, in fact, if you want to see my chicken article, That's at richsoil.com, and that's where I keep my articles, including the one about the Wafati.
Mm-hmm.
But the big site that everybody loves is permies.com, and that's where the permaculture enthusiasts go.
Cool.
Okay. What was that first one you said?
Richsoil.com. So, I should probably plug stuff that I sell.
Yeah.
I've got my World Domination Gardening DVD, and I've got a 4-DVD set about rocket mass heaters. This is where you can heat your home with 1/10 the wood.
Yeah, we didn't even get around to that conversation. That was
I know. We have to have a call back, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back just for a whole show on the rocket mass heaters.
We saw one recently at a friend's farm and thought, we need to do this. And
did you see it burning?
Yes, sir.
So isn't that crazy how the fire burns sideways?
Yes, and it is amazingly warm and cozy and so economical on wood.
Yeah, it's putting out so much heat, and you look in, and it's like, really? It's putting out this much heat, and that's all the wood it's using?
Tiny little fire, yeah.
Yeah, and then
it's
like
super heat. It's a super combustion.
The other fascinating
part, I get the science of it. That's the cool part, is I get the science. I love the science.
The other fascinating part is when the fire's been out for over 24 hours and it's still throwing out heat.
Yeah, amazing. I am so excited about having one in the house. And Terry, of course, says we're going to have to build one outside in a cabin first so we don't burn down the house. I'm okay, fine. Yeah. That makes sense. Okay.
I think it's with a rocket mass heater, you're much less likely to have any kind of problems than if you use a conventional wood stove.
Mm-hmm.
I think these are far.
My other concern is that there is a full basement beneath the living portion of our house.
Yeah, he's concerned about
and
the
we're
weight.
We're looking at several tons of mass to be a proper heat battery, and I'm looking at the floor saying, maybe not. And my mass stove being in the garage.
Okay, so yeah, we have things to talk about.
Okay. Okay, so we will have Paul back to talk about rocket mass heaters next time.
So, Nat, I hope you didn't wander too far off from your normal topics.
Not at all.
I
enjoyed this immensely. Thank you.
A lot of our shows wander aimlessly. We just go where we're led.
Mm-hmm. It's what people need to hear, and it's, you know, admittedly, sometimes it's what we want to know. But amazingly, there are lots of people out there who want to know what we want to know. So it seems to work.
All right. Well, I'm glad I could lead you around.
Yeah, it was fun. Thank you. I look forward to having you back to talk about the rocket mass stove. That's definitely something that we're going to be working with. And, you know, any you know, pointers I can get on that will be hugely appreciated. So we'll communicate with you over the weekend or next week and see what we can do about getting you back on the show maybe in October.
Okay, sounds great. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Paul. You have a great night.
Paul, thanks a lot for being with us. All right, so... if you want to get in touch with anybody from the station, as long as we're in the how do we get in touch with people section of the show, you can get in touch with us any host or panelist or guest. If you have any questions that you want to get to Paul, you are welcome to email CERN.org@gmail.com, and you can get get a message to us, and we'll pass it along to Paul or any guest that you hear on the show. Let's see, if you want to get in touch with me or Robin, our joint email address is littlestonebridge@gmail.com. And you can find our Facebook page. Let's see, there's a Facebook page for Spiritual Unity Radio Network. There's also one for Little Stone Bridge Pathworkings. Go check out those two pages. Little Stone Bridge Pathworkings is where we're talking about our workshops and events up here at the mountain, where we're going to be talking about some of the workshops. We're going to be going out and speaking to some groups. And I guess now's the time, as good a chance as any, to plug. If you would like to have us come talk to your group, email us at that littlestonebridge@gmail.com address. And we'd like to talk with you about that. So let's see. Robin, how does somebody get in touch with you individually?
The best way is probably my Facebook page, Robin A. McKean, or the Facebook page for my show with Lisa that I do every week right here on Spiritual Unity Radio Network. That Facebook page is Spiritual Wellness Physical Health.
All right. And if you're trying to get in touch with me directly, you can find me on Facebook, Terry Power in North Copley, Pennsylvania. Or check the public figure page, Rev Terry Power HP. That's another one of those where you click like. That's where all the pictures from our travels and my travels and all the cool stuff that we do when we're out and about, those pictures end up usually start there. And again, that's Rev Terry Power HP. And follow me on Twitter at Rev Terry Power HP. So there's all the business out of the way.
Yay. So
that was pretty cool. Sorry you missed the first part of that. But
me too.
Very interesting. I do look forward to talking with him more about the rocket stove.
Mm-hmm.
That is definitely something that we want to build. And I gathered from his comment about we have a lot to talk about that my concerns are real. About
possibly.
The weight,
yeah,
you know, several tons on a floor is just probably not what it's designed for. So we'll have to look at that. But anyway, looking forward to that. Very interesting ideas on permaculture and basically letting the mother do her thing,
mm-hmm.
and getting out of her way.
Yep, absolutely.
That's pretty much what I took from mm-hmm. a lot of his comments. Just basically get out of the mother's way and let her have her garden,
mm-hmm.
and we'll just go pick stuff.
Yep. Yeah.
So I think that's about it. I've got. Did you have any final thoughts that you wanted to pass along before we?
Not too much. Just the fact that I was so thrilled to have Paul on the show, and looking forward to learning more and talking more to him. And do go and check out his websites, therichsoil.com and thepermies.com. I've looked at them both, and there's a lot of really interesting information there. To keep you reading and reading and reading. And he has what he calls a daily-ish newsletter. And it shows up in my inbox, and it's got a lot of cool suggestions and stuff in his newsletter as well. So do go and check him out. And I hope somebody out there, heard something tonight that was helpful to them. I know I did. And as always, I tell everybody to just enjoy and spread the love this week.
All right, and have a week filled with love and with wonder. Good night, everybody. Bless you, baby.
Good night.
I'm flipping switches. They don't want to go. Here we go. Try them again.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. Join us 7 nights a week for exciting programming covering a variety of expressions of faith. And remember, all manifestations of the divine are equally valid.